Blog Talk Radio.
To Paranexus Universe. This is your host, Doug Kelly, along with my good friend and co-host, Grant Rubin Dunst. Welcome, Grant.
Hey, good evening, everybody, and happy Friday night.
Yeah, another Friday night. Glad everybody is taking the time to listen in. We've got another great guest with us tonight, very special guest. Michael Cremo is on the cutting edge of science and culture issues. In the course of a few months' time, he might be found on a pilgrimage to sacred sites in India, appearing on a national television show, lecturing at a mainstream science conference, or speaking to an alternative science gathering. As he crosses disciplinary and cultural boundaries, he presents to his various audiences a compelling case for negotiating a new consensus on the nature of reality. He is the co-author of Forbidden Archaeology and the author of Human Devolution, his latest book. Michael Cremo is a member of the History of Science Society, the World Archaeological Congress, the Philosophy of Science Association, the European Association of Archaeologists, and an associate member, and you're going to have to pronounce that one for me, Michael.
The Bhaktivedanta Institute.
Thank you. Specializing in history and philosophy of science, Michael Cremo, welcome to the program.
Oh, great to be with you and all your listeners.
Thank you so very much. It's wonderful to have you.
Yes, it is. So let's go back. You know, Michael, this is obviously the first time you've been on our program and maybe first mention for many of our listeners. Can you just give us a brief understanding on where you started with this whole thing and we'll kind of take it from there?
Well, the beginning has something to do with my encounter with the spiritual tradition of India. When I was in my 20s, I was looking around the world for different systems of thought that made sense to me, and I became attracted to the teachings of ancient India. I came in contact with one of the teachers there, one of the gurus. His name was Bhaktivedanta Swami. He was one of George Harrison's teachers. He was known for bringing what's called Krishna consciousness from India to the Western world. And through him, I became interested in studying the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, among which are a group called the Puranas, or the histories. And these histories tell of human civilizations, of a human presence on this planet, going back tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of years, right back to the very beginning of the history of life on Earth. So that was something completely different than I'd ever been told by any of my teachers in high school and university. So I thought, along with my co-author, Richard Thompson, that if there's any truth to what these ancient writings are saying about extreme human antiquity, then there should be some physical evidence to support it. And of course, this idea that humans have been around since the beginning of life on Earth is something that we find not just in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. Practically all the great wisdom traditions of the world say the same thing. It's there in the Bible, it's there in the Quran, there are the teachings of ancient Rome and China and Japan and among the Australian Aboriginals and Native American peoples. It's a fairly widespread tradition. So we thought if there's any truth to what these ancient sources are saying, there should be some kind of physical evidence to back it up, some kind of archaeological evidence that humans have been around for a lot longer than many scientists now think possible. So I looked in the recent textbooks of archaeology and anthropology and history and things of that sort, and I didn't see any such evidence there, but I decided to look a little bit further than that. I decided to look beyond the textbooks to go into the original archaeological reports from individual researchers from around the time of Darwin up to the present. And that required going through what I call the primary archaeological literature, the original reports by original investigators in many different languages. Fortunately, I have a reading knowledge of most of the European languages, so I was able to go through that literature. And what I began to find was very interesting. When I looked at these original reports, I began to find many cases in which archaeologists had reported finding human bones, human footprints, or human artifacts many, many millions of years old. And I had to wonder, well, if these things are there in the original scientific literature, then why aren't they mentioned in the textbooks and the other kinds of secondary literature? And what I discovered was the only reason that I could see that these reports, although present in the original scientific literature, were absent from the textbooks, is that these discoveries happened to contradict the Darwinian theory of human evolution. So when I first started the research, I thought I would do maybe 8 weeks of research, that I might find one or two or three interesting cases and write a short article about it or something, and then go on to something else. But as I started going deeper and deeper into the research, one case led to another, and the 8 weeks of research that I had planned turned into 8 months, and then the 8 months turned into 8 years, because I found there were literally hundreds of these cases, not just a few. So the result of it all was the book Forbidden Archaeology, which contains detailed discussions, detailed documentation of all of these discoveries of archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity. It's a 900-page book. It's also out in a shorter edition called The Hidden History of the Human Race. If 900 pages is too much, we cut it down to a more bite-sized chunk. But it seems most people who are interested in the book prefer the larger book, strange as it seems.
Well, they want the info.
Yeah, they want everything, every possible detail. So that's what got me into that. And then after that book came out, readers started asking, well, if you don't accept the Darwinian theory of evolution, you have all this evidence that contradicts it, then what are you going to put in its place? Where do you think human beings came from? So the result of that, of trying to answer that question, was my latest book, Human Devolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. And just to put it in a nutshell, what I say in that book is that we didn't evolve up from matter, rather we have devolved or come down from a level of pure consciousness or spirit, if you like that word. And in that book, I say that, before we would really ask the question, where did human beings come from, we should first of all ask the question, what is a human being? Because today, many scientists are going to say that a human being or any other living thing is just a combination of chemicals. But I propose in this book that if we carefully look at all the evidence, we'll see that a human being is made of three things. Ordinary matter, there's a gross physical body made of ordinary matter, the ordinary chemical elements. But beyond that, there's a subtle material body made of mind, other types of energies that have very unusual powers. And this takes you into what we might call the realm of the paranormal, such things as psychokinesis, telepathy, and things of that sort. And then beyond that, there's a conscious self that can exist completely apart from the body and the mind, and there's evidence for that as well. So that is kind of in brief the story of how I began this research and where it led me and what literature, what books came out of the research.
It's an amazing story. How long has this time period encompassed now?
Well, I started work on the book Forbidden Archaeology in 1984, and then that was about 8 years of research and writing, and then the book was finally published in 1993 in English, and then since then the book's been published in about 20 languages around the world, and then after that I began work on human devolution. My books tend to take a lot of time to write. I wish I could put them out more quickly. I wish I was a more prolific author, but I just find I want to make these books as well researched as I can. So
it took me
a while to get out that book, Human Devolution, which has been out a couple of years now. And at the present moment, I'm working on a sequel to Forbidden Archaeology, because in the years since the first book came out, many more cases have come to my attention. It's enough to put another book together. So that's what I'm working on at the present moment.
You know, Michael, I had a question in regards when you're doing your research taking all the photographs and going to the museums. How receptive were the folks to showing you all that stuff? I mean, not that I think there's a big secret, but I just had this picture in my mind of obscure artifacts being tucked away in a corner box someplace and nobody really paying much attention to them. Would that be halfway accurate?
That is, to some extent, accurate. Each case is a little bit different. For example, let's look at the case of the California gold mine discoveries.
Mm-hmm.
In the 19th century, you know, gold miners went to California during the gold rush, and to get the gold, they were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains in the Sierra Nevadas, places like Table Mountain in Tuolumne County in California. And deep inside their tunnels, the miners were finding human bones, human skeletons, and human artifacts, obsidian, spear points, stone mortars and pestles, all kinds of things. And these discoveries came to the attention of Dr. J.D. Whitney, who was the chief government geologist of California. A Harvard-educated geologist. And he went out into the gold mining regions. He collected a lot of these artifacts. He documented the circumstances of discovery. And what he found is very interesting, because these things were being found in layers of rock that, according to modern geologists, are about 50 million years old, which is really quite amazing, because according to the standard theories, humans like us have only been around for about 100 or 200,000 years at most. Before that, most scientists don't believe humans like us were present. They think the only thing that existed were more primitive human-like ancestors, various kinds of ape men, in other words. So these discoveries of human bones and human artifacts from layers of rock about 50 million years old were reported, you know, by Dr. Whitney to the scientific world. His report was published in a publication that came out of Harvard University, a scientific publication. But, you know, we don't hear very much about these discoveries today because of, you know, the process of knowledge filtration that operates in the world of science. There was another scientist who lived around the same time as Whitney was William Holmes, who was an anthropologist working at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. And he said, you know, if Dr. Whitney had understood the theory of human evolution, then he he wouldn't have published that report. In other words, if the facts did not support that theory of human evolution, then the facts had to be put aside, and that's what happened. Now, after the book Forbidden Archaeology came out, I was approached by a man named Bill Cote, who was a television producer. He was putting together a special for NBC called The Mysterious Origins of Man. It was hosted by Charlton Heston. And he asked me to be a consultant and to also appear on the show. So the show featured a lot of the material from the book Forbidden Archaeology. And when he was filming the program, I told Bill Cote that he should go to the Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley, because I knew that some of the artifacts from the California gold mines were still in the collection of the museum. At that point, I had not been to the museum myself. A lot of the reports I just had from the scientific literature. And when he went there, the museum officials denied him permission to see those artifacts. They said, no, you can't do it. They gave all kinds of excuses at first, but finally they just told him, no, you're not going to see them. So that does happen sometimes, that these artifacts are there in the museum collections. They're not displayed to the public, and they aren't made available to researchers whose ideas may be different than the museum officials. This is something, I mean, we tend to think, well, it's there, anybody can see it, but it's often not the case. A couple of years later, I was doing some research on these California gold mine discoveries for a paper that I presented at a meeting of the World Archaeological Congress, which is the world's largest international organization of archaeologists. So I went back to the museum myself, and perhaps because of my connection with the World Archaeological Congress, they decided not to deny me permission to see them. Of course, you have to go through a pretty rigorous procedure to get permission to see these artifacts. The first thing I had to do is I had to make a special trip to Berkeley, to the university there, to meet with the museum staff and then make an appointment to go through the museum catalog with them just to specify what artifacts I was interested in seeing. So I did that. And then what they did is then they submitted my request to see those artifacts to a special research committee, which has the ability to say yes or no, to deny the request or approve it. I think because my purpose was to make a presentation at a meeting of the World Archaeological Congress, they decided they would give the permission. So then they scheduled a time a couple of months in advance for me to actually come to the museum and see the artifacts. Now, when I went there, I was accompanied by one of the museum officials to another building. These artifacts weren't even kept in the museum itself. They were kept in a storage building several miles from the museum. So I had to go there in the company of a museum official who was with me every second of the time. And when we got to that building, it was a scene something like out of the first Indiana Jones movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they go into the Smithsonian, the old, and see all the stuff that's really there. I mean, it really did have that sort of air about it, because there's very high security there. You had to go through all these, through these doors with, card readers and punch keys and then there was somebody with me at every second of the time, but the artifacts were there. I was able to photograph them. And so there is that sort of air about that. I've also have been to several archaeological museums and in Europe, and you have to go through the same procedure. You have to make an application. I mean, you can't just walk in and look around and see these things. So the access is very much controlled. And I think one reason why I've been able to get access is because I have a record of publishing papers and presenting papers at international conferences, scientific conferences on archaeology and anthropology. I think for that reason, even though I'm a bit of a maverick and a very controversial person in the world of archaeology, they decide to give me, in these cases, access where I can actually verify that these objects that are mentioned in the scientific reports are still there.
How do your colleagues, Michael, in traditional and mainstream archaeology explain things like what you just described, the California Gold Rush, but how would they explain like those Transvaal spheres?
Well, typically, of course you have to consider the world of science isn't monolithic. There are all kinds of people in the world of science. There's one group that I call the fundamentalist Darwinists who are very much opposed to me and what I say. They don't want to hear what I have to say. They don't want anyone else to hear what I have to say. And I think they accept, the Darwinian theory of evolution for reasons that aren't completely scientific. I think they support it because it fortifies their prior belief in atheism and materialism. And for them, it's a kind of an ideology. And if you're against it, then they're against you, no question about it. Then there's another, that group, the fundamentalist Darwinist, is a minority in the world of science, but a very influential and powerful minority. They're actually, you could say, steering the ship. They're in the driver's seat. But there are many more scientists who are larger in number who accept the theory of evolution for more or less scientific reasons, which means they're willing to consider evidence that goes against it. They're willing to consider alternative theories and ideas. And it's scientists in that group who invite me to speak at universities, who accept the papers that I present at major international conferences on archaeology and anthropology and history of science. And they're open. They're willing to listen. And I think that's important because if ideas are going to change, that's the first step, as scientists have to be willing to listen to a new idea, to new evidence. Now, in that group, there are some who actually agree with me. So each group is going to take a different approach to the evidence. Those are the first group, say if we're talking about the Transvaal spheres, which you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Those are some round objects that have been found by miners at a place called Ottosdal in the western Transvaal region of South Africa. The objects are 1 or 2 inches in diameter. They're made of a naturally occurring type of iron called hematite. So they're a kind of iron, which is a kind of metal, and the most interesting feature of them is the parallel grooves that go around the center of each object. Some of them have 3, some of them have 2, but they have these parallel grooves that go around the center of these round objects made of hematite. So what's really interesting is they're found solidly embedded in layers of rock about 2 billion years old. So each group of scientists is going to react to a report like that in a different way. The fundamentalist Darwinists are going to say, no way, no way at all. That something's got to be wrong there. It's either a hoax or a mistake. The dating methods were wrong. Something's wrong. They were formed by nature. They were... there's all kinds of different reactions, whereas others are, they're willing to consider at least the possibility, although it really doesn't fit in to most scientific theories of human origins these days. So it depends on who we're talking to, how they're going to react to things like that. But for the supporters, the strong supporters of the current theories of human origins, the first thing they do is they just start giving a whole list of how they think it's possible the discovery could be wrong, without really demonstrating that any of those things actually apply. You know, they say, oh, it's obviously a hoax, but they don't try to show who hoaxed it, how it was hoaxed, or they want to say the dating methods were wrong, but they can't explain how the dating methods were wrong. They will want to say maybe the object slipped down into a very ancient layer of rock from some higher level, but then they don't show how that happened. You know, mostly they just give a list of possibilities how something could be wrong, and from that they extrapolate it is wrong. There is something wrong with the evidence.
That's, you know, what you're talking about here strikes me as, you know, it's something that we deal with all the time. Because what we're talking about here, Michael, are belief systems, right? And people will defend those belief systems pretty much at all costs. That's what you're talking about regarding...
Yeah, some people definitely, if they've got a heavily invested interest. Of course, everybody's operating in terms of a particular belief system. So, I mean, you've got to have some way of sorting these things out. Of course, it's very easy, you know, if we're operating in a world in which there's just one belief system and one standard for evaluating evidence. That would make things very easy. But the fact is that we live in a world where we have people operating according to different belief systems. So, how are we going to evaluate the claims that different people operating under different belief systems are making? I think the only thing we can do is we can agree on some set of standards for judging evidence. We can have some common system for judging evidence, and then we can try to draw some conclusions.
What would you suggest?
But here's another point. But the fact is, although that's ideal, what we find is that people from different belief systems, they often apply a double standard in how they treat evidence. And I find this is particularly the case where you have mainstream science, which is operating according to a belief system that excludes this idea of extreme human antiquity, with a view that excludes many features of what we call the paranormal, or sure, evidence for consciousness existing apart from matter. So what they tend to do is they tend to apply a double standard. If there's evidence that goes along with their theories, along with their paradigm, along with their worldview, along with their belief system, it tends to be treated in one way, very leniently. But if there's evidence that contradicts their worldview, that contradicts their paradigm or belief system or theory, then they react in a different way. They subject that evidence to heavy negative scrutiny. Now, all evidence is imperfect. I think we have to admit that, because as human beings, we're not perfect. You can always find some problem with any type of evidence. But what happens in practice is that they apply a much stricter standard when looking at evidence that contradicts their paradigm, their belief system, than they apply when they look at the evidence that supports their theory. It's like, for example, if you have a policeman who for one group of people overlooks all kinds of little infractions and things, and but for another person who he doesn't like, will throw the book at them, or like a building inspector. Say a building inspector has a big book, Code of Construction Principles or whatever, and say for, you know, he could probably condemn any building in the city if he wanted to, this building inspector, because right, you could probably in any building find some little things that's wrong or not up to the code or something. But say for his friends, he sort of lets it slide by. But if he's got someone he doesn't like, then he goes very carefully through the book, and whatever he can find that's in violation of the code, he makes a big deal of, even some little infraction, and then condemns the building. So I think this is what often happens in the world of science, that those who are in the belief system that is currently dominant in the world of science will tend to apply the standards of evidence unequally to evidence that supports their theory. They'll be very lenient about it. They'll overlook little things that are suspicious or whatever. And for evidence that contradicts their theories, they'll just seize upon any little possibility of doubt and raise it to the level of saying that the evidence has to be rejected.
So would it be fair to say that they're not really striving to find the truth, but they're striving to support a belief system?
Yeah, so they think they already know what the truth is. And I think it's all right that in the world that there are competing claims for truth. It's very unusual to find a person who is just completely, totally without any convictions, without any beliefs, who's just looking, you know, at the evidence and then has got most scientists, and I'm not saying this is something wrong. Even Einstein said it. You know, he said you have to start out with some idea, otherwise you don't even know what evidence to look at, you know, because there's just so much evidence in the world. You have to kind of narrow your thoughts a little bit and start thinking about what it is you want to show or not show. So I think that's all right. But I think there has to be some fairness in the process, you know.
Shouldn't the quest be to find out how it all fits together?
I think that is,
I mean,
what I would say is true.
Right.
I think the hallmark of a good scientific theory is that it lets you integrate various types of evidence from many different fields to answer important questions, which is what I tried to do in my book, Human Devolution, to show that, you know, there's evidence that human beings aren't just a combination of chemicals. We're a combination of matter, mind, and consciousness, and that's the best explanation for our origins, that originally we are beings of pure consciousness who have come from a level of pure consciousness, and that appears to me to be the best explanation for what we experience every day. But many scientists today, they start out with the assumption that consciousness cannot exist apart from matter. They say, no, we have to start with matter. And there's nothing apart from matter. All we can talk about are different combinations of chemicals. And if you try to go beyond that, then they say, okay, you're not talking science now. You're talking now about something else. Now, I think that is unfortunate, and I think that's unfair, because I think a real scientist will want to consider everything that's possibly true about the world. And one thing that is possibly true about the world is that consciousness may exist apart from matter. That is something that is really possibly true about the world. So if we're going to define science in such a way as to rule out that possibility from the very beginning, then that means our science is not dealing with everything that's possibly true about the world. And as you say, then that means you've segregated science from the whole truth.
You've almost alienated science from taking a total different perspective.
Yes. And I think that those are decisions for the individual scientist to make. I think if a scientist decides when he's looking at the evidence that, yes, the evidence suggests humans have been around since the beginning of time, or if the evidence suggests that we're beings of pure consciousness that have come down from some level of pure consciousness or spirit, if you like that word, then fine. If that's where the evidence leads that particular scientist, then I think that is perfectly legitimate for a scientist to do that, if we're going to say that science is a genuine search for truth. there shouldn't be any preset limits to what conclusions a scientist can reach and what he can't. Once you do that, you're no longer really interested in the truth.
Well, let's go back to something you just mentioned on the consciousness. You're basically saying that humans are made up of matter, consciousness. What was the third one?
Well, here's how I look at it.
Chemicals.
I think there is a gross physical body made of the ordinary material chemical elements like carbon, iron, oxygen, hydrogen. Beyond that, I think there's a subtle body made of mental substance. And this mental substance, it's material, but it's subtle. It's sort of like a magnet. It has a field of magnetism that goes out beyond just the physical body of the magnet. So I think we have a body made of ordinary matter, but there's a subtle mental energy which goes beyond the limits of the body, and enables us to do things like perceive things at a distance, or some people are able to manipulate this mental energy in such a way that it can act on ordinary matter. It can cause ordinary objects to move without anything apparently touching them. So, and then beyond that, there is a conscious self that can exist apart from matter. You could think about it in terms of a computer analogy, that you've got the physical machinery of the computer, the hardware. That would be like the body made of ordinary matter. Then you've got the computer software, which I would compare to the mind, to the mental energy. And then beyond that, there's the computer user, who is consciously using the software and hardware, just like the conscious self, according to the system I'm proposing, is making use of the mind, making use of the body to perform its physical acts. But just like the computer user, he can get up and walk away from the computer. The computer user is different than the computer with its hardware and software, although many people are starting to think that they really are their computers these days. But actually, you can actually live without them. You can get away from them.
You can't. Say it isn't so.
And that means the essence of our being is pure consciousness. I think it has a source. I think it has a source in a reservoir of pure consciousness. I think that's where it comes from. So yes, I would say, and there's scientific evidence for all of these things, but just to clarify, I think we're made of three things. The body made of the chemical elements. There's a subtle material body made of mental energy, mind, and then beyond that, there's the actual conscious self.
So you're segregating the conscious self and the mind.
Yes, just like, and we can see this ourselves. Today, we might think, well, today, mentally, I'm feeling very happy. My mental outlook is very positive. But we see that our mental state can change. We can at times feel depressed, or we can feel frustrated. Maybe we're working on a problem. We can't do it. Or sometimes our mind feels very lazy. I mean, I encounter this as a writer. Sometimes there's writer's block. And mentally, you want the words to be flowing out, going into the computer, onto the paper, whatever. But just mentally, there's some sort of block there. So I think we can distinguish between the conscious self and the mind, because the conscious self can observe, you know, the different states of the mind. Now, obviously, there's some connection there, too. There's feedback between the conscious self, the mind, and the physical body. But although they are now integrated as a system, I think we can see that each has its separate identity. Just like when we're using a computer, you've got the computer user, the computer software, and the computer hardware that are integrated as a system. Mm-hmm. But each part of the system has its own independent existence. For example, you can change your computer, and then you can put your same software and the same user using a new computer. or else you can keep your computer, but you could change your software. You can go from, say, something Microsoft to a Mac or something software, or you can change the user. You know, you could have your computer, your software, and then a completely different person could come and use your software and your computer. So although we could say that computer hardware, software, and the user are in a sense one system, actually they're three separate things that
okay, so
can operate apart. So I would say yes, you could take this might lead us into, say, a phenomenon like reincarnation,
mm-hmm.
where a conscious self goes from one physical body to another, you know, one after another. So, yes, I would say, yes, the conscious self is different than mind, and it's also different than the body of gross matter.
Let me wrap this up, and then, Grant, I'm going to turn over to you. Just
sure.
this thing you're talking about, the mind, almost sounds like the attitude. It's very similar, would you agree? Like a person's attitude?
Yes, but in the system, now a lot of what I'm talking about comes from my studies in the ancient Sanskrit writings. And they characterize mind as something material, but more subtle than the ordinary material element. It's actually a very fine, subtle material energy that can operate on ordinary matter. So just like you have, the mind you could consider to be something like air. Now we can't see air, but air has a physical existence. And if air, you know, the invisible air element moves over a denser element like water that we can see, then we can observe the action of the invisible air element on the visible water element. We can see waves forming, for example. So mind is something like that. It's not something that we can see, but it's like a physical energy field, a subtle physical energy field that can actually operate on ordinary matter in strange ways. I think it's something that many scientists have actually observed. But there's, just like there's a hidden history of archaeology, there's also what I would call a hidden history of physics. For example, Marie and Pierre Curie are two famous physicists. Every high school physics student learns about them when they first study physics. They were husband and wife. They both got Nobel Prizes for their discovery of radium. And that's something that we see in the textbooks. What we don't see in the textbooks is that the Curies were involved in psychical research. They were part of a group of 20 prominent European scientists who were conducting such research in Paris early in the 20th century. And this group did 2 years of studies with a medium, an Italian medium named Eusebio Palladino. And these experiments were not taking place in someone's dark living room, which is the usual kind of picture that people have. These experiments took place in the Psychology Institute in Paris. And on one occasion, you know, they had the medium in the laboratory. Marie Curie was holding her hand. Another scientist was holding her feet, controlling her movements, making sure she wasn't moving at all. And in the middle of the lab, in broad daylight, under what he characterized as perfect conditions of observation, Pierre Curie, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, said he saw a large table floating about 3 feet off the ground. So how was that happening? You know, according to the system that I'm talking about, the medium was able to manipulate the subtle mental energies in such a way as to influence the action of ordinary matter. So I would say this mind, it's not just an attitude. It's not just mind is an actual subtle material energy force field that some people are able to manipulate in such a way that they can do things that violate the laws of physics as we understand them. I think this mental substance, this mind field, this mental energy can also be used to gather information through extrasensory perception and things like that.
Okay.
It certainly makes you wonder, Michael, if, you know, for that system, I would imagine like any normal natural system, it's going to want to stay in a state of homeostasis. And it makes me wonder, you know, what really is fascinating about it is, what if there's an imbalance? You know, maybe that would explain, you know, like a poltergeist case like you just kind of alluded to, which really is a very fascinating way of of viewing the whole human being as a system, a very intricate system.
Yes, that you could say, yes, there may be some disturbance in the system. And if a person is not in control of their mental energy field, it may be used, you know, it may, you know, cause material objects in the neighborhood of the person to start behaving in an unusual way. Of course, there are other possible, you know, explanations for that, namely,
yeah,
that there might be, because here's something that I think could happen, according to what I'm talking about. It's possible for the conscious self to exist completely beyond mind and matter, but there may be some conscious selves that are associated only with mind, and people have had different names for these beings. You know, they've called them astral beings, angels, gods, goddesses, or whatever. But it may be possible for a being to exist as a conscious self only in contact with a body made of the mental energies. So, and then it's possible for other beings, like ourselves, to be conscious selves covered by mind and also by a gross physical body. And usually, beings on our level, you know, that are this body, mind, conscious self system, we tend to channel our activities through our gross physical senses, the senses of the gross physical body. Now, in the poltergeist cases, and in the medium cases, and the cases where people are able to display paranormal powers, it may be that even though they are channeling their mental energies through the gross physical body most of the time, they're able somehow or other to decouple their mental body from their gross physical body and then use it to do things that really aren't conceivable from the standpoint of the, you know, just people operating with their normal physical bodies. So that may be responsible for, that may be an explanation for many of the paranormal phenomenon and the poltergeist phenomenon. But another possible explanation for some of these phenomena is that there are beings who don't have gross physical bodies, but who have bodies made of this subtle mind element that is actually able to influence ordinary matter. And that's another possible explanation for poltergeist phenomenon and paranormal phenomena of certain kinds.
So it's safe to say that you believe in what people would normally call spirits.
Yes, and I think there are a couple of kinds. There are many different kinds. Some are in that position because of things they've done that are not motivated, let's say not motivated by love towards all conscious beings. You know, they've been put in that position of, say, what people would call a ghost, because maybe they committed suicide, for example. I think the human body is a vehicle which, if used properly, will enable us to achieve higher levels of consciousness with the eventual goal of freeing the conscious self from all of its coverings. You know, just like a geologist will, or a metallurgist will be able to tell us how to extract the element gold from its ore, where it's mixed with other less valuable elements. So I would say that the main purpose of human life is to free the conscious self from its coverings of mind and matter and restore it to its originally pure state where it exists on a level beyond all the kinds of changes that the gross physical body and the mental body undergo. So that's, and the human body is developed in such a way, is designed in such a way that it can do that if it takes up different practices of yoga, meditation, consciousness control, self-realization. It can do that. It can restore, one can restore the conscious self to its original and pure state. But some people don't use the vehicle of the human body in that particular way. Some people may destroy their own physical body through suicide or something like that. And in a position like that, they may be, their subtle material body may be full of all kinds of material desires that require a physical body, and they won't be able to satisfy those desires, so they'll try to possess someone who does have a body and try to take over that body so that they can use it to fulfill their unsatisfied material desires. And there are cases like that. And sometimes it may be with some other motive. You know, there's an interesting case that was reported by William James, the father of modern psychology, in his textbook, Principles of Psychology, which he wrote at the beginning of the 20th century. And there, William James documented what he, as a professional scientist, considered to be a genuine case of spirit possession. And that was a case that became famous as the Watseka Wonder. And Watseka is a little town in the state of Illinois. And in the 19th century, there was a family there, the Venom family. They had a daughter named Lorancy. And Lorancy Venom lived a normal life, you know, until, you know, she was in her teens. And at that time, she started going into what they called spirit trances. And in these trance states, she encountered spirits of people who had departed this world. One of them was the spirit of a girl named Mary Roth. And this girl, Mary Roth, told Lorancy Venom in this trance state that she wanted to visit her family on Earth. And after that happened, Lorancy Venom apparently agreed to let this spirit possess her body. And after that, she did not feel at home with her own family. She didn't recognize them anymore. She was in a very sad state. So the family went out and searched, and they found members of this Roth family, and they brought them to the Venom house. As they were coming up to the house, you know, the girl, Lorancy Venom, looked out and said, "Oh, that's my mother, that's my sister." She recognized, you know, the people who were coming up who she'd never seen before. And both families agreed that she should go and live with the Roth family. And she did that for several months, manifesting all kinds of knowledge that would have only have been known to Mary Roth, you know, detailed facts about the family's history, intimate personal family history, things of that sort. For months, she just behaved perfectly as their daughter, Mary Roth, until she started going into the trance states again, and then the spirit of Mary Roth said, I've seen my family again. I want to go back to where I came from. And then when that happened, Lorancy Venom no longer felt at home in the Roth house. She didn't recognize anyone anymore. She was very homesick for her own house, for her own family. So then both families agreed, you know, she should go back to the Venom house, which happened. Now, what I found interesting about this case, it's reported, you know, by the father of modern psychology, William James, in his textbook, Principles of Psychology, as a genuine case of spirit possession. So now how would I explain that in terms of the model that I proposed, that you've got the gross physical body, the subtle mind elements, which contains all the memories and things like that. You know, just like in your computer, you've got the software, but the software has in its memory, you know, all your files and programs and things like that, so that you can transfer the software with all its memories, memory files, to a completely new computer. And then when you run in that program on the new computer, you've got all the memories from the other computer, when it was installed in another computer. So what I'd say, what happens is this. You've got the spirit soul, the pure being, of the being of pure consciousness, Mary Roth, who has left this world in her mental body. She left her gross physical body behind, but because she wasn't on the state of pure consciousness, she was existing more or less on the level of these mental energies with her mental body, which contained memories of her life on Earth. When in the trance states, the spirit of Lorancy Venom came up to that level, they decided somehow or other to let this spirit of Mary Roth with her mental body, her memories, inhabit the gross physical body on Earth of Lorancy Venom for some time. And that's what happened. And then at a certain point, it left. You know, the spirit of Mary Roth with all her memories and associations left. And then Lorancy Venom was able to continue acting again on her own. So you've got these spirit possession cases that sort of can be explained according to the model that I'm proposing, that we've got a gross physical body, a subtle body that contains all of our memories and things like that. And then there's the conscious self, which can exist apart from all of them.
Okay, that's very interesting, and we're going to continue this discussion here in just a few minutes. We're coming up on the top of the hour, and we're going to take a short break here. We are talking with Michael Cremo, co-author of Forbidden Archaeology, and his latest book, Human Devolution. Some interesting concepts here, and the thing that's so neat about it, Michael, is that it applies to the audience that we're talking to as well. It can perhaps give us a different perspective on things or look at things in a unique way that might even yield some answers. So appreciate that. To our listeners, we really appreciate you listening. We're not quite over yet. We still got the second part of the show to go. In the meantime, we'd like to encourage everybody to visit our home site. It's paranexus.org. It's a professional association of paranormal researchers, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, and ufologists. Take a look. We are continuing to build it and add more content. We're really striving to have a very nice, top-notch professional association of serious researchers, folks who really want to take it to the next level. That's paranexus.org. We are talking with Michael Cremo, and we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back, so stay with us.
The West Georgia Paranormal Research Society is composed of individuals with a common goal, the scientific investigation of the paranormal. It is our hope that these investigations will allow those of us in the paranormal community to bring about answers that will benefit us, as well as helping to educate the general public. We approach all investigations and questions with the utmost professionalism and confidentiality required for the situation. If you are experiencing strange occurrences around your home or place of business, such as unexplained noises, smells, or visual phenomenon, these could be possible signs of paranormal activity. If you're interested in finding some answers to these questions, or if you'd like to have our team investigate the activity, visit us at www.wgprs.com for more information. Research, assistance, understanding. We're here to help you.
And we're back. This is Doug Kelly, host of Paranexus Universe, with my good friend and co-host, Grant Rubin Dunst. Welcome back, Grant.
Hey, thanks, Doug. It's good. It's great to be here this evening.
Yeah, we have a very interesting conversation going on with our very special guest, Michael Primo, co-author of Forbidden Archaeology and author of Human Devolution. Welcome back, Michael.
Great to be back.
Yeah, some very interesting stuff that we are talking about here as it applies to so many areas, especially the area of parapsychology, paranormal research. One of the questions that I wanted to ask you, Michael, we were talking about consciousness being separate from the body and the mind and all that, and one of the things that just amazed me the first time I heard it, and still amazes me for that matter, is that science has not been able to actually locate the mind and therefore the consciousness, and I know you separate them, but I'm going to use kind of both of them. Isn't that true?
Well, yes, that is true. When they, I say they look at a phenomenon, it's called the binding problem. say they know there are different parts of the brain that deal with vision, for example. But even that is broken up. There are certain parts of the brain that deal with motion, certain parts that deal with color, certain parts that deal with shading, certain parts that deal with other things related to vision. Then there are other parts of the brain that deal with things like hearing, other parts of the brain that deal with touch, other parts of the brain that deal with other things, the sense of smell, for example. But what we experience, however, each of us, is that we are consciously aware of a whole integrated real-time display where we're seeing, we see our friend, you know, come in the room, we hear him speak to us, maybe he's smoking a cigarette and you can smell it or something like that. It's an integrated display. And they don't know where in the brain, they can figure out, okay, this part of the brain is dealing with smell, this part of the brain is dealing with vision, this part of the brain is dealing with touch, hearing. But where is the part of the brain that is integrating all of those things into a single display that we are consciously aware of? Nobody has figured that out. Now, I have a way of accounting for it myself. In my system, this subtle mind element is kind of like some very sophisticated multimedia software that integrates sensory inputs from the gross physical body and puts them together in a visual display. But just as if on your computer, you may have some very sophisticated multimedia software that will integrate sound and vision, for example, into a display, a film, for example, that you can put together. But unless you've got a person actually looking at the computer, nobody's going to see it. You know, it's not going to be experienced, even though all the elements are there. You know, the computer is there, the software is there that's integrating the visual imagery and the sounds and putting them together in a sophisticated way. But unless you've got a person who's actually looking at the screen and seeing and listening to it through headphones, the whole thing isn't going to exist. So I would say our body is something like that. Yes, we've got this gross physical body with its senses. What's integrating all the sensory input? I would say it's the mind that's integrating all of those sensory inputs, putting them together in a unified display. But what is it that's looking at it? What is it that's actually experiencing that integrated display? That is the conscious self proper. And just like, as I said, you've got the computer hardware, you've got the computer multimedia software putting all the inputs together, but you have to have the separate person, the computer user, who's actually observing it for the whole system to exist. I think what scientists today have done is they've run into incredible problems just trying to explain everything in terms of the hardware alone, in terms of ordinary matter alone. And I don't think they're going to make any real advancement until they start integrating into their thinking this idea of a subtle mind element, which is material, which is subtle, but which exists beyond the gross physical body. And then beyond that, beyond the mind, there is this conscious self that is the source of our conscious experience of the things that the body and mind present to us.
Let me see if I can just sum up this real quick. So this is an interesting concept. So what you're saying is we've got the body, we've got
gross
the mind. Gross physical body, we've got the mind, we've got the consciousness. And what you're saying is that the mind is the tool, if you will, that integrates the consciousness with the gross physical body?
That's right. Just like the software. Absolutely. Just like the software is what lets the computer user, the conscious computer user, interact with the computer hardware for specific purposes. So that's a very good way to put it.
Okay, very good. Okay, so now let me make one other comment just to see if I'm following you correctly. So now if we apply this to the paranormal, to paranormal research and so forth, you kind of, if I'm correct, you said that, for example, when a person dies, their mind, their mind doesn't quite, they haven't fulfilled everything they needed to fulfill while they were alive, so to speak. So their mind is what survives, and we commonly refer to them as ghosts, who then interact with people, try to get in touch, try to complete unfinished business, etc. And then you've got those that have completed it, and they move on to the other consciousness. Their consciousness moves on.
Yes, there's, and there, the conscious self has its own senses and mind that are integrated with it, that aren't different from it. It's as if what we're experiencing now is a virtual reality system. Because in the state of pure consciousness, there are senses of pure consciousness. There's a mind of pure consciousness, but they're all integrated. They're not separate. There's not a difference between body and self. Now we're in a position where the body is different from the self. Even the mind is different from the self. We have to struggle with the mind. The mind sometimes overcomes us and forces us to do things we don't want to do things of that sort. But on the level of pure consciousness, all of these things are integrated. They're all part of the identity. But what happens is on that level of pure consciousness, the ruling principle is love. On that level of pure consciousness, we exist in harmony with the source of all conscious beings, with all other conscious beings. And there's sensory experience there on the level of pure consciousness. But what happens if a conscious self on that level of pure harmony becomes selfish, wants to control everything, wants to become the center? It's not possible. That is not possible on that level. So what happens is the conscious self comes down to the level where we now find ourselves, and its original senses are covered over, and it's provided with an artificial reality system, a virtual reality system, where it can act out its selfish desires, along with many other conscious selves that are in the same position, which is why I think we find the world that we inhabit full of competition and conflict on the level of individuals, societies, nations, religions. It's a world of conflict and competition because each conscious self on this level is trying to be number one in one way or another. So what we have, what we're in now, is what I would call a virtual reality system. And you know how that works. I mean, you know, a person, their normal vision, their eyes can be covered by little television screens that you just see. You no longer see what you would normally see. You see what the computer is generating. And it can be interactive, too, so that you can walk around in the virtual reality system. You can encounter other forms of human beings in the virtual reality system. Some of them are very sophisticated, but it's not the real world that you're meant to live in. In other words, your ordinary sensory inputs on the level of pure consciousness are cut off, and they're replaced by another set of sensory inputs that's generated by what we could call the computer of the material world. You might call it something like that. So if we come to the level of pure consciousness, we're still going to have sensory experience, but it's going to be sensory experience of a kind we can hardly imagine today. Sometimes mystics, you know, who go into trance states, they're able to kind of experience these things through different disciplines, spiritual disciplines. But for most people who exist on this level that we find ourselves now, yes, they find themselves with a virtual body, you could say. It's just like in a virtual reality system. You can create a virtual body for someone. Or in a computer game, essentially the same thing goes on. You get lost in a computer game. You just identify with whatever identity is given to you in the computer game, and you can just completely lose all touch with your normal state. You know, if you were to walk away from the computer game, you'd find you have your own life, your own friends, your own enemies. But in that computer game, you've got the identity, the friends, the enemies that are generated by whoever made the game, whoever put it together. So,
okay,
it's actually quite a complicated system, really.
Okay, so let's take this a step further. Now, in the world of paranormal research, it's speculated that, well, we've got the ghosts, the spirits, et cetera, that are earthbound. Those are the ones you were referring to as unfinished business. They hadn't fulfilled everything here.
Yeah.
Then we've got these others that are what we refer to commonly as inhuman spirits. In other words, they never walked the earth as a human before. People commonly refer to them as angels, guides, controls. You know, even religiously, they refer to them as demons, some of the malevolent inhuman spirits. Do those types of beings have a place in this philosophy? Are they the consciousness?
Yes. Yes, those would be beings who exist on the level of the subtle material elements, mind, principally. Now, the subtle mental body, this is a more refined view, but the subtle mental body also has subtle senses. And there are senses for acquiring knowledge, and there are senses for working. For example, according to the system that I'm proposing, say if we leave the gross physical body with unfinished businesses, we're going to leave with the mind element, and the mind is also going to be accompanied by subtle material senses, and they're of two kinds. One is the knowledge-acquiring senses, like vision, and the other is the working senses, like, according to what I'm proposing, say our arms and legs would be considered senses because they allow us to work. They're called working senses. And there's some, in ordinary bodily consciousness, those subtle material senses operate through the organs of the body. For example, the arm sense, the grasping sense, will normally operate through the physical organ of the arm. But there's an interesting medical phenomenon called missing limb phenomenon, where people who lose, for example, I hate that this would happen to anybody, but sometimes it does in war or an automobile accident or something. But a person will lose an arm, for example. And many of these people, they report still feeling as if they have an arm. They can feel it, still localized. They can move it. They can even feel pain in it. Yeah, they might feel like a prick, a pain in a finger or a thumb or an elbow joint or something like that. And it's localized pain. It's not just some memory. It's something they're actually experiencing at the moment. And physicians have a name for it. They call it the missing limb phenomenon. And some of them try to say, well, it's just memories firing. But these people who are in this position, they report being able to move their subtle limbs. They can feel they have localized sensation in it. So it doesn't appear to be just memory. And I was at one conference on consciousness studies where I met a physician who told me that even people who are born without, say, an arm, they still have the same phenomenon. They still have the same sensation of experiencing having a subtle limb. So I think this idea that I'm proposing, that we have a subtle mental body in addition to a gross physical body, helps explain some interesting phenomena like this phantom limb or missing limb phenomenon, this phantom limb phenomenon that you can search through in the medical literature.
Hmm. Yeah.
And it would also explain, I think it also explains how something like extrasensory perception or remote viewing works. Because normally the subtle visual sense operates through the the eyes that we have stuck in those holes in our skull. But if what I'm saying is true, that visual sense can also operate outside those physical organs. And I think that is something that will explain a phenomenon like remote viewing, for example.
Hmm. Well, you know, the eyes are just receivers. It's the mind that sees. And just in case I missed this somehow, please forgive me if I did, these inhuman spirits, as they're referred to, they are that the consciousness, that consciousness element who has moved on from the need of this physical, the gross physical body?
Yes, and but not from the needs of the subtle physical body. I think there's a level of the cosmos. There's one level of the cosmos that's dominated by ordinary matter, and that's where we find ourselves now. I think there's another level of the cosmos that's dominated by subtle mental energies, and that's inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there. And you've given some names for them, and people have different names, ghosts, spirits, astral beings, gods, goddesses, angels. And then beyond that, I would say there's the level of pure consciousness.
And they don't visit.
Which is where we're originally from. It's where we're supposed to go, but it's up to us how we choose, what kind of choices that we make, what we choose to identify with. For example, I mentioned this virtual reality idea. For example, people get addicted to different things. Some people get addicted to different computer games, for example, and they just live in those games, in those virtual reality systems. They more or less forget their real life outside, or just even when an ordinary person goes to a movie. I mean, basically, you have a life outside the movie. You go into this dark room. You sit down with a bunch of other people who've also come off the street, and some lights start flashing on the screen. And because we identify with them, we begin to experience certain emotions when we see the flashing lights on the screen. Now, if the directors, who produced the film, has done a good job, that identification is there. If we didn't identify, then we wouldn't experience anything. We'd just sit there and just be some flashing lights on the screen. But if the director has done a good job, we identify with some of the flashing lights on the screen. For example, if it's James Bond, say as a man, we identify ourselves with those flashing lights on the screen, so that if James Bond meets a beautiful woman, that we feel really good about that. Or if he's confronted with one of his enemies, we feel like, okay, we got to fight now. But it has nothing to do with our real lives, really, outside the theater. We've just gone in there, we've identified with what's being presented on the screen, and we experience ourselves as part of that whole thing that's going on, when, in fact, our real life is something completely different.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, some interesting analogies that you're using that can seem to make sense. Now, so for our listeners, you're talking about the subtle mind now as well, that some of these inhuman, now these inhuman or these non-human, is there a place, they've never been human, but they still exist as sentient beings. Is that what you're saying?
Never been in a human body, you could say, yes. Okay. That's possible.
Okay. So how about this? Okay, so some interesting things. So basically we have come from there and we're headed back to that consciousness, that pure consciousness, which is governed by pure love, correct?
Yes, that is the ruling principle there.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, let's swing this back to the physical world here and what you've talked about in Forbidden Archaeology. What are some of the things that you have discovered that really don't fit? I mean, some interesting discoveries that really you don't find out about on the documentaries or that are there, but science is
right. Yeah, well, it's important to you know, realize how that fits together with all this paranormal and psychical and
yeah.
consciousness stuff. Because, you know, how it fit together for me was that today science has a worldview that's based on matter alone, everything. Consciousness has to be reduced to chemical interactions in the brain. Mind has to be reduced to chemical interactions in the brain. The origin of the gross physical body has to be explained in terms of simpler levels of organization until you finally you just go back to chemicals. And there has to be some evolutionary explanation for how simple chemicals combined together to form the first living thing. And then it gradually evolved simply by a material, purely material process of evolution by natural selection. We're told that the human form evolved with consciousness. So everything is reduced to matter. And that means really after the matter disappears, there's nothing. We don't exist anymore. You know, to think that there's some afterlife or something that's beyond the body is just, according to that system, a whole lot of imagination, fantasy, wish fulfillment, and things of that sort, which I think has produced a very, not only is it not true, because there are some things that aren't true that don't harm you, but I think the current scientific theories of human origins and the origin of life and the origin of consciousness and mind and all that, I think they're not only wrong, but they're harmful. You know, they lead us in a direction that just produces a lot of trouble for all of us. So,
but isn't the real crux of the problem here, Michael, the fact that what traditional science wants is they want something that can measure? And how do you measure consciousness?
I think you could, without consciousness, you couldn't measure. So we have to see what's primary. I mean, where does even the idea of measuring come from? I mean, consciousness is the basic fact of our existence. Without consciousness, you wouldn't even be able to talk about measuring something. So I think we have to go back to what's...
Well, let me clarify. I think that in traditional science, if I could just clarify, my understanding of traditional science, where they get hung up a lot of times, especially in paranormal research, is being able to replicate the data that we capture. And so that's what I think in terms of measurement. I'm in 100% agreement with you, but I'm just wondering if that's the way they can discount all of this on the basis that, you know, if I can't count it or I can't touch it and tweak it, it doesn't exist.
Right. Well, I would say that that's part of what science can do. But if you limit yourself to that, your science isn't dealing with everything that's really true about the world. So I think you have to have different, and this is true just in terms of even ordinary science, you have to have different kinds of science for different types of phenomena. The principles that you use in terms of just ordinary physics aren't going to work in biology in all cases. And, I mean, one aspect of science, the life sciences, is zoology. And zoology is meant to give an account of all the different life forms that exist. So that means that the science of zoology has to be based on observations of things that may not have been observed before. And each year, scientists actually discover thousands of new species, either living species or fossil species. And sometimes even some of them are quite big, like, you know, big new species of shark, for example, or a big new species of squid. So some areas of science aren't based on repetition. They're based on observation, new observations of interesting things. So I think it depends on having a scientific procedure that's adapted to the phenomenon that you're talking about. Now, for example, what if you had an astronomer that was looking at the sky with just an optical telescope, and then you have another scientist who's looking at the sky through, say, an X-ray telescope? Now, the scientist who's looking at the sky through the X-ray telescope is going to maybe, you know, he can see a source of X-rays in a certain quadrants in the sky, certain location in the sky. And he might point that out to the other astronomer who's just using the optical telescope, says, wow, I see there's a really fantastic source of X-rays. It's really highly visible. And the astronomer with the optical telescope may look over there and say, well, I don't see anything there. And then the other side's going to come, well, of course you don't see it because you're not looking through the right instrument. And then you have to look through the X-ray telescope. And then the other side's going to say, no. I'm a scientist. I'm an astronomer. The optical telescope is the instrument. If you can't see it through the optical telescope, it doesn't exist. All right, if that's the way you want to be about it, then fine. But then you're not dealing with everything that really does exist. Yeah, just because it may not be observable through your instrument or accounted for in your particular methodology. So I do think, and I agree with you, that that is a problem that limits scientific investigation, commitment to just a particular kind of instrument, a particular type of theory, a particular type of background assumptions about what really exists in the world. So, yeah, I agree with you on that. That can be a limiting factor. But to get back to the other question that I kind of digress from, why there are these interesting archaeological phenomena, the reason I think they're important is because they suggest we need another explanation for human origins. And when we start to do that, build from the ground up, I think we have to start accounting for things like consciousness of mind in a different way than many scientists are now prepared to do. But one interesting case comes from the United States, where in the 19th century, at a place called Nampa in Idaho, there were some people that were drilling a well, an artesian well, and they had drilled down through some very thick layers of lava, and then they went further down into some different layers of sediment. And at a level of about 300 feet, they brought up a beautiful little statue of a female form, a perfect representation of the female form. And according to modern geologists, it came from a level. If you go down at that level, at that place, 300 feet, you come to a certain formation that, according to modern geologists, is about 2 million years old. So that's really extraordinary that you have art, human art, coming, which shows very advanced level of consciousness, an ability to think symbolically like that. That is a human feature. And according to most scientists today, artwork of that kind, little statues of human figures, are something that only go back about 30,000 years or 40,000 years or so. So to have that kind of thing coming up from a level 2 million years old was really extraordinary. So this came to the attention of a scientist, a geologist named George Wright, and he published scientific articles about it, but you're not going to see anything like that in today's textbooks because it just doesn't fit the current theories. And if some scientists hear about it, then they try to explain it away in different ways. For example, they say, well, it's a hoax, or somehow or other it came down into that level from some fissure or something like that, when nothing like that has ever been demonstrated, and all the evidence kind of goes against those kinds of explanations. So that's another case that I found interesting.
So, I've read in some books about coal seams and mines where they have unearthed gold jewelry, various items. I don't know if any of that is anything you've come across, but it's millions of years.
Yes, that is. For example, there's a case. See, some cases are very extreme. They don't come from the scientific literature, but I think my position is if this kind of evidence really is there in the layers of the earth, then not just scientists are going to be finding it, but ordinary people are going to be encountering it. And their reports, although they won't be found in the scientific literature, will be found in other types of literature, for example, newspapers and things of that sort. So there was a case, you were mentioning a gold chain, there was a case like that that was reported in the Morrisonville Times. Morrisonville is a town in the state of Illinois. And in the year 1892, there appeared a very interesting report in the newspaper in that town, Morrisonville Times. A woman named Mrs. Robert Culp was putting some coal into her coal-burning stove, and there was one big piece of coal that she broke in half, and inside, you know, she found a gold chain about 10 inches long. Now, from the report, you know, we could tell what mine the coal came from. So what we did is we got in touch with the geologists of, you know, there's the State Geological Survey of Illinois. So we got in touch with a geologist from the State Geological Survey, and we asked him, how old is the coal from this particular mine? And, you know, it's from the Pennsylvanian period, that's a geological period or whatever. It turns out to be about 300 million years old.
Whoa.
So to me, I mean, this report, you know, provides evidence that you've got a gold chain that was found solidly embedded in a piece of coal that was about 300 million years old. Now, if you go to the scientific literature from the 19th century, there's a scientific journal called The Geologist that published an interesting report that a human skeleton was found about 90 feet below the surface of the ground in Macoupin County in the state of Illinois, lying just on top of a bed of coal. And above the skeleton was a thick layer of slate rock that extended for dozens of yards in all directions. And that layer of rock was unbroken. And that's an important detail because sometimes when people hear about a case of a human skeleton being found in some very ancient layer of rock, well, their immediate counter statement is, well, it has to have come down from, you know, from some higher level. And because the according to geologists of the state of Illinois, the layer below the slate rock where the skeleton was found is about 300 million years, you know, the same age as the gold chain found in the same state, also in a piece of coal. So this detail that the layer of slate rock was unbroken, the layer of slate rock above the skeleton was very thick and it was unbroken, shows that the skeleton cannot have come down from some higher, more recent level. Because if that were the case, that layer of rock above the skeleton would have been broken. So it's an interesting case. So, yes, you do have these reports of extreme human antiquity, human skeleton 300 million years old, a gold chain also 300 million years old from the state of Illinois here in the United States.
Michael, were those skeletons anatomically consistent with modern humans?
You know, according to the report from the scientific journal, The Geologist, there was a physician, a medical doctor, present at the time of the discovery, and the bones were determined to be human, you know, by a medical doctor. So I would say yes.
Mm-hmm.
There, now, that particular, in some of these cases, the original objects are no longer to be seen. But in some cases of human bones of very ancient date, they are still able to be found. You know, for example, I mentioned the California gold mine discoveries. So some pieces of anatomically modern human skulls were sent from California to museums in Boston and Philadelphia. And, you know, I have a researcher now who's tracking those down, but in other places I've been able to see the artifacts and bones myself in different museums.
Now, have those bones been subjected to radiocarbon dating, to your knowledge?
Some of the bones have been. For example, we can consider the case of the human skeletons that were found by the Italian geologist Giuseppe Ragazzoni at a place called Castanedolo in northern Italy. They were anatomically modern bones from four different skeletons. They were found in layers of rock about 4 million years old. And we have to consider that according to scientists today, anatomically modern humans supposedly came into existence only 100 or 200,000 years ago. So to have these skeletons at 4 million years is really quite astonishing. So Ragazzoni, the scientist who discovered them, was a professional geologist, and he conducted his excavations very carefully because he was very much aware of this problem of what's technically called intrusive burial, and this idea that, well, yes, the skeleton may be found in some very ancient layer of rock, but how did it get there? Someone must have dug a grave, you know, from some higher, more recent level and put it down there. So he was very much aware of this problem. He said when he was taking the skeleton out of the ground, he could see that all the layers of rock above the skeleton were intact and undisturbed, meaning that there was no burial, that the skeleton really did belong in the layer of rock in which it was found. So I take that as very good evidence that for the existence of human beings like us existing about 4 million years ago. Now, in the 1960s, there was a scientist from England who came down and found some fragments of those bones in a museum in Italy. And he did some carbon dating on them, and he got a very young date for them. So does that mean that, well, really the human bones aren't 4 million years old? Maybe they're 10,000 years old or something like that? We have to consider, however, that this radiocarbon method, it's only accurate back to about 50,000 years, or maybe 100,000 years. We have to understand how this radiocarbon dating method works. It's based on the idea that there are two kinds of carbon in a living thing. One is carbon-12. It's the isotope carbon-12. It's not radioactive. There's carbon-14, which is another isotope, another form of carbon, that is radioactive. So the radioactive carbon will decay into other elements, whereas the other carbon, carbon-12, will just stay in its form as carbon. Now, so after something dies, a human being dies, the amount of ordinary carbon, carbon-12, in its bones will remain the same, but the amount of carbon-14 will start to decrease gradually by what's called half-lives. You know, the half-life of carbon-14 is about 5,000 years. So that means if you have a certain amount of carbon-14, after 5,000 years, half of it will be gone. And then after another 5,000 years, half of what's left will be gone. And then after another 5 years, half of that will be gone. And then after, and so on, until you get to around 50,000 or 100,000 years, and then there's no measurable carbon-14 left. That means that you can only date things back to about 100,000 years maximum. But here's something that's very important to understand. Say if we have some human bones that really are 4 million years old. If they get contaminated with the least amount of modern carbon-14, then when you run that carbon-14 dating on the bone, even if they're 4 million years old, they will show an age of 100,000 years or less because of contamination with recent carbon. And that can happen in many ways. It can happen when the bone is in the ground because the bone can get infiltrated with bacteria. There's organic material in the ground through groundwater. The organic material can infiltrate the bone, and modern carbon-14 can thereby be introduced into the bone. Another way that the bone can be contaminated is simply by touching it. Even because our skin contains oils that contain carbon, modern carbon-14. So even by touching a bone, it can be contaminated with recent carbon. Another way that the bone can be contaminated with recent carbon, if it's treated with organic preservatives, which was the case with the bones from Castandolo, they were treated with organic preservatives. And then also the bones, in the course of lying in a museum for about 100 years, they can be further contaminated by bacteria and fungus and touching and things like that. And so unless one can remove all the contaminants, which is very difficult to do, it's practically impossible, you're not sure how old the bone really is using this radiocarbon method. And we wrote to the scientist who conducted the radiocarbon dating of these bones, and he said, yes, the kinds of contamination that you say are possible, they are possible. We said, but still I think my date is right.
The thing that's really interesting is what it makes, what it conjures in my mind is I'm wondering about the works of Dr. Leakey down at Odovorian or the gorge down there. How did they know that Lucy was 4 point if the measuring device that we're using is completely questionable?
Well, in that case, see, there are other methods for dating bones. Say there's the radiocarbon method can be used only to about 100,000 years. And there you've got all these problems that are related to contamination of the bone. Now there's another method called the uranium series method that can be used to date bone that goes back a few hundred thousand years, 300,000 or 400,000 years. If you go beyond that, there is no method that scientists have today that will allow them to date the bone itself. So they have to use other methods, other radiometric methods that will allow them to date the age of the layers of rock in which the objects are found. So if you have Lucy, for example, which wasn't discovered at Olduvai Gorge, it was discovered in Ethiopia by Don Johansson. But they have, what they did there is they determined that above, I mean, it's very interesting the kind of reasoning that they used. The bones of Lucy were actually found on the surface, but they suppose, studying the local geology, that they were weathered out. They were eroded from some layers of rock from a hillside that are beneath a layer of volcanic rock. Now, volcanic rock can be dated using a method called the potassium-argon method, or the argon-argon method, it's sometimes called. And there, they were able to date this layer of volcanic material as being about 3,300,000 years old or something. And the bones of Lucy, if they were in their original position and not on the surface where they actually found them, but they think that if they were in their original position, they would have been below that layer of volcanic ash, 3,300,000 years old, and therefore the bones must have been about 3,300,000 years old. So that's how they operate. Now you can obviously see that there's a lot of assumptions going on there. A lot of assumptions about, you know, because the bones, as I said, were found on the surface, not in some excavation, not intact in some layer of rock. So they assume that they were found in a certain layer of rock beneath a certain layer of volcanic deposits. And then you've got the dating method, which has its own problems, because volcanic ash crystals can also be contaminated. They can lose some of their argon gas or whatever, and you know, the dating could also be off in certain ways. Now, that leads some people to ask me, well, you know, what are we doing here? But what I say is this. As far as I'm concerned, the dating methods may all be totally unreliable and wrong, But I have to have some framework of discussion with the archaeological scientists and the scientists in this field. So the way I operate is this. I tell them, according to methods that you consider reliable, this layer of rock is so-and-so many million years old. So how do you explain the presence in that layer of rock, which you say is, say, 10 million years old? How do you explain the presence in that layer of rock of this anatomically modern human bone, or this anatomically modern human footprint, or this human artifact that most archaeologists would say was made by a human being of our level of intelligence? And then it becomes a problem for them. Either they have to admit that all their dating methods are totally unreliable, which means there's really no science of archaeology, or they have to admit that their theories of human origins are wrong and are in need of revision. And either way, I win.
Yeah, that's good. Interesting stuff. Very interesting.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's fascinating.
How old do you think the human race might be, Michael?
Well, my proposal is that humans have been around since the beginning of the history of life on Earth. And today, most scientists would say that life began on Earth between 2 and 3 billion years ago. But actually, the oldest undisputed fossil evidence for life that they have is fossils of single-celled life forms, kind of like algae, that go back about 2 billion years. But my point would be is that, yeah, life began then, but it wasn't just the simplest forms of life that were present at that time. There were more advanced forms of life also there, including human beings. And we talked a little bit earlier in the show about the case of the hematite spheres from, you know, those round objects made of the naturally occurring iron called hematite that come from South Africa that have the parallel grooves that go around the center of each object. They were shown on that television special, The Mysterious Origins of Man, that I was a consultant for and that I appeared in, and that program features many of the cases from the book Forbidden Archaeology. I should point out that television special, which was originally aired in 1996, has recently been re-released, The Mysterious Origins of Man, in a DVD form that includes the complete interviews that were filmed of me and my co-author Richard Thompson, and the actual show that was broadcast. You know, they're just part of the total interviews, but this new release has the complete interviews. But in any case, before those round objects with the grooves going around them were filmed for NBC, NBC said they had to be submitted to an independent company of metallurgists to examine. And when that was done, the metallurgists reported they could not explain how those objects could have formed naturally in the layers of the earth, which means we have to consider the possibility they were manufactured by someone with human-like intelligence, and that must have been about 2 billion years ago, because that is the age of the formations in which those objects were found. So I would say the age of the human species goes back to the beginning of the history of life on Earth.
Okay, we're coming up on the top of the hour. We've got about 5 or less minutes left here. Let me ask you this. In your whole paradigm, where did we come from?
Well, that's the topic I get into in my book, Human Devolution, A Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. And to put it very briefly, I say before we even ask that question, we should first of all understand what a human being is. I mean, before we ask where human beings come from, we should know what we are, because otherwise, how can we tell if we've properly explained it or not? So today, many scientists are going to say that a human being is just a combination of the ordinary material elements, like carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, whatever. And that's all there is to it. We're just a highly complex organization of molecules, of ordinary matter. But when I look at all the evidence that comes from various fields of science, I see it's more reasonable to say that a human being or any other living thing is a combination of three things. Ordinary matter, yes, that's part of what a human being is, but beyond that, there's a subtle mind element with some very unusual powers like telekinesis and remote viewing and things of that sort. And then beyond that, there is a conscious self. And I propose that that conscious self is primary. That is what we really are. And that conscious self comes from a source that is also individual, conscious, and personal. So I would say we begin our existence as beings of pure consciousness. But if we depart from that level, we enter into the lower regions of the cosmos and become covered by the lower energies of mind and ordinary matter. So that's what I mean by devolution, the process by which a conscious self becomes covered by the lower energies of mind and matter. So really, we do not evolve up from matter, as most scientists now believe. Rather, we have devolved or come down from this level of pure consciousness, and that's where we came from. It's possible to return. There's devolution, but there's also re-evolution. You know, it's possible to restore consciousness to its original pure state. And there are many techniques of consciousness transformation that are to be found in various ancient wisdom systems, different systems of contemplation, yoga, meditation, that are really meant to help us do that, restore consciousness to its original pure state. And I think that's the real purpose of human life, from which we become distracted by too much materialism.
All right. Interesting. All right. So we're coming up at the end of our show here. Got a couple of minutes left. We've talked about a lot of very interesting things, even as it relates to paranormal research. And this program, of course, will be archived. So if you missed this most of this program, or you're coming in later, we're on. So go to the website. You'll see the archive, Michael Cremo. And, it a lot of food for thought. That's what I think, a lot of food for thought. Folks, visit not only Paranexus.org or a professional association of researchers, but also you want to visit Michael Cremo's website. You want to pick up the book, Forbidden Archaeology, and also his latest, Human Devolution. You can get those at ForbiddenArchaeology.com, HumanDevolution.com. There is some links on Paranexus.org. If you look for Michael's bio page there, you'll find it under ParanexusRadio.org. Michael, anything else you want to add to where people can find out more about what you're doing?
Well, like you mentioned, they can visit my website, my personal website also, mcremo.com, mcremo.com. The books are also available there. They'll also find a schedule of lectures that I'm giving in different places, upcoming media events, and things like that.
That's great. We really appreciate the time that you've taken to be with us tonight. I know that our listeners have no doubt found it very interesting, especially with what we do. So we appreciate that very much. Folks, be with us next week. We have got, I believe we've got Jason Valenti, don't we, Grant, next week?
Yes, that's correct.
Sasquatch research, so that should be also an interesting show. And Michael, if you'll hang with us just for a moment. Folks, appreciate your time, appreciate you listening to Paranexus Universe, and tune in again next Friday night for another great episode. Listen to the archive on this. There's a lot to take in this one and a lot of things to kind of fit into place. So, Michael, once again, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Grant, until next time, you hang in there, my friend.
Will do, Doug. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Good night.
In the shadows, in the sky. It's Paramex's universe.